the ghosts that you're talking about, are they wearing clothes or are they naked? And almost always, without fail, they tell me that they're wearing clothes. Okay, so now you're asking me to not only believe that a person's immortal soul survives after their death and transcends the spirit world, but their clothes also have this supernatural ability to transcend death?
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, what is a humanist chaplain? Hint, it's not Charlie's brother. Some talk about belief, secular morality, and an atheist who can justify it. All coming up on this week's episode of the Humanist Hour. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Beau Bennett. I'm your host for this week's episode. I wanted to share with you a philosophical paradox that I read the other day. And I've never read this one before. I read a lot of them, but this one I found very entertaining and very interesting, too, on many levels. You might have heard it before, and if you did, just sit back and relax, because not everybody has, so don't be selfish. All right, here we go. It's about a teacher who wanted to give a quiz to their students the following week, but only if it was a complete surprise. So the teacher told the class this, and one of the wise-ass students, Smart Alex, raised his hand and said, well, you know, you can't give it on Friday, because if Friday arrives, then we know it's going to be on Friday, and it won't be a surprise. Teacher says, oh, yeah, okay, I guess you're right. And he says, you know, we can't give it on Thursday, because we know you can't already give it on Friday. So if Thursday arrives, and we haven't had the quiz yet, well, we know it's going to be on Thursday, so it won't be a surprise. Teacher says, yeah, I guess you're right. And then he says the same thing for Wednesday, and Tuesday, and Monday. And ultimately, the teacher says, yeah, you know, you're right. I can't give you a quiz next week. So there will be no surprise quiz, so don't worry about it. And then the next week comes, and then boom, on Wednesday, he gives the quiz to everybody, and everybody's surprised. A more common paradox is called Zeno's paradox, and you probably heard of this one before. This is the idea that you can never get anywhere, because you always cover half the distance before you actually reach the point. So if I'm going from point A to B, I have to cover halfway first. And then if I make it to that halfway, I have to cover another halfway and another halfway and another halfway, an infinite number of halfways. So therefore, I never technically reach the destination. So you say, well, wait, how could that be? Because obviously I could get places. And same thing with the teacher. How could you not possibly logically give a surprise quiz? Because obviously they do all the time. And this is one of the things that really annoyed me about philosophy. And it kind of pushed me away from philosophy and into psychology, more the science of it, especially applied as an applied science, when we could actually measure results. It drove me crazy, and especially with religious arguments, because we see philosophical religious arguments everywhere. And not only for, but also against the idea of religion, they go both ways. But when it comes down to these philosophical arguments, if you look at them, and if you sincerely look for responses to these arguments and take away any kind of confirmation bias that you have, and don't just look for the answers you're looking for, but look for answers on both sides, you'll find that these arguments can be very convincing on both sides. And maybe if you are some high-level professional philosopher and you might have all the answers. I don't know. I've never taken philosophy that far. But I could certainly tell you from the average person's perspective, even a well-educated person, these arguments are very convincing, even though that they have no merit. And I think that's proven by all these logical and philosophical paradoxes that are out there. I mean, there are literally hundreds of them that will just keep you scratching your head all day. So the moral of the story is, don't be bamboozled by what might sound like a logical argument. Sometimes you need to put the logic aside and focus on reason. All right, so let's get into today's interview. I'm going to be speaking with Mr. John Figdor, and he is the humanist chaplain at Stanford University and the author of the book called Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart. I have the great pleasure of speaking with John Figdor. How are you, John?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing wonderfully. Thanks for being on with us. There's so many things I want to talk to you about, but let's start with your position as the humanist chaplain. What the heck is a humanist chaplain?
Good question. So humanist chaplains are a new phenomena. The oldest humanist chaplaincy is the Harvard Humanist Chaplaincy, which was founded in the 70s. And my organization is the newest humanist chaplaincy, which is at Stanford University, which we launched 2 years ago. Humanist chaplains are in some ways similar to traditional chaplains, but in a number of significant ways quite different, starting with the fact that we don't believe in God. So this isn't some kind of like we're secret believers and we found this great atheism gig on the side. We're people who serve in the role of college chaplains, but for the non-religious student population. We provide a variety of different services, ranging from counseling and support, even talking to students when helping them deal with being away from home for the first time, being in an elite academic environment, like a place like Stanford or Harvard. And then we also advocate for their interests from within the Office of Religious Life, which is a little bit different from doing it from the outside. We work alongside the other chaplains to plan programs, which make sure that the humanist voice is included at every step in these conversations. We also host events on campus, whether it's our weekly meeting that we host for students or large-scale public events with people like Richard Dawkins. We try to bring an educational aspect to the campus and educate people about humanist ideas and speakers.
How do the other chaplains there treat you? Do they treat you like a second-class citizen, or are you equal among them?
No, I mean, in some way, it really doesn't matter how they treat me because we deal with such different student populations. I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's an enormous surge in the non-religious population. At Harvard this year, statistics came out suggesting that 36% of their incoming class is non-religious. At Stanford, it's 22.7%, and it's actually probably higher than that. These are conservative statistics, to say the least. And as a result, there's me and, 25% of Stanford's 20,000-person campus. And meanwhile, there's 35 religious chaplains for the other 75% of Stanford students. So I'm more than busy taking care of the atheist, humanist, agnostic community. I'm not really affected by the other religious chaplains, except for when we want to do interfaith projects and service work.
So can you walk me through your average day? I'm still trying to get a sense of, I know you described all these great things that you do, but what do you do like on a regular day from a day-to-day basis that makes this a full-time job?
Well, let me try to give you some understanding of what humanist chaplains do. Our time is basically split between three main aspects of our life. The first one is tending to our community, which is the students, the faculty, the staff, and people in the local area who are looking for support, who are looking for counseling, who are looking for those kinds of resources that a traditional chaplaincy might provide. Then on top of that, we have the public service and public events aspect of our organization, where I'm working with other religious organizations to do interfaith service projects. We're trying to run our own service projects. Like just last week, we held a walk for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And in addition to that, we host large-scale public events with folks like Richard Dawkins, or just last week, Eugenie Scott. And then the last thing that we do is to advocate for the non-religious perspective from within the Office of Religious Life at Stanford, which gives us the ability to kind of push to make sure that the university includes the non-religious perspective in all of their programs and lets them understand what religious life is like for non-religious students at the university.
Okay. So do you have any students who are religious or spiritual humanists, or are they all secular humanists?
I don't actually ask everyone to tell me all of their beliefs, and so I'm not sure what some of my students believe on their own. None of my students have volunteered any supernatural or superstitious beliefs. We do have people who come to our organization and they're doubting their religious beliefs. They're starting to think about whether or not they make sense, and they come to us looking for a different perspective. So that's kind of what we have, but often those people quickly abandon their religious beliefs and embrace a secular way of thinking, or they kind of realize, no, they do believe after all, and then they tend to return to religious organizations.
So there are 7 humanist chaplains in the country, in the United States, and that's it so far?
Right. Yeah, there's one at Harvard, one at Yale, one at Columbia, me at Stanford, one at Tufts, one at American University, and one at Rutgers. And then there's another exciting one in California. We just got another one, which is Bart Campolo launching University of Southern California's humanist chaplaincy just this year.
Nice, nice. So how do we go about getting more humanist chaplains? What's involved in getting these universities to jump on board?
So it's quite an arduous process. In some of these places, these talks have been underway for 5 or 10 years at a time before we can get someone appointed.
Wow.
At Stanford, fortunately, the former dean of religious life, Scotty McLennan, actually was very welcoming, wanted to have a humanist chaplain on campus, was sympathetic to the humanist position himself. And so I found it quite a welcoming reception onto campus.
Hmm.
But that said, I think the biggest challenge that lies for humanist chaplains is the fundraising aspect and the ability to fund their programs, because universities, except for Tufts, which is a distinction unto itself, all of these universities require outside organizations to provide these chaplain staff to the universities. And that's very difficult to ask someone to not only have the skills necessary to provide counseling and support, but also to have the entrepreneurial and fundraising experience enough to raise enough money to run an organization.
Sure.
And so it's quite a difficult job. But if you have the interest in doing it, we train almost all of our humanist chaplains out of Harvard University. And I encourage people to apply and try to get in and try to forward this mission of creating more opportunities for secular students at universities.
Is there like a waiting list where somebody is waiting for a humanist chaplain to be trained and ready to go to a university? Or is it more waiting for universities to accept these chaplains? Where's the bottleneck?
The bottleneck is at the university level. There is a lot of reluctance right now to accept humanist chaplains. At Stanford, we were kind of received with open arms, but that's an exception. For the most part, this is something that has to be negotiated over quite a long period of time. In fact, I had been courted for a while to serve as a humanist chaplain with one group, and then I saw that it was taking too long and the deans of religious life at the school were not ready to make a decision, and I decided to take a different offer out here at Stanford.
Hmm.
It really is a bottleneck at the university, and it's something that we need to make clear that universities have to provide this resource to students. Now that, I don't know if you saw this, but Barna.org, which is a Christian polling organization, released polling data that shows that 38% of Americans are essentially secular. Now, that's not just the student population. For people under the age of 30, it's 48% of people are essentially secular, which they define as not going to churches or synagogues or mosques except for a wedding or a funeral.
Yeah.
That's a huge number. If 40% of a college campus is secular, then you have to look at an office of religious life that has 35 religious chaplains and one person serving the non-religious population and say, hey, hang on a minute, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't reflect the nature of American society anymore. And especially at prestigious institutions of higher learning like Stanford and Harvard, where there's a disproportionately high number of atheists and humanists, we really expect that support from the university in the coming years.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with John Figdor, author of Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart. All right, so let's move on and let's talk about your book. You co-authored a book titled Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart, Rewriting the Ten Commandments for the 21st Century. What is that about?
So the book is, we wrote the book because a number of people came to me through the years in my role as a chaplain, asking for advice and kind of good discussions of what they should do with their lives, kind of some of these big questions in philosophy. They were often left at this point where they said, look, I've given up my belief in God. Now what? Hmm. What's next? What's worth believing in? And so in the past, I could point them to a book chapter here and a blog article here and a video here and a TED talk there. But there wasn't really a coherent attempt to build from the ground up a worldview. And so that's what we decided to do, was to provide people a kind of a guide, not in what to believe, but in how to build your beliefs. And that's the most important aspect of it, which is it's not taking away our Ten Commandments and thinking that these are the new Ten Commandments and everyone has to follow them. We made the very conspicuous choice of calling them non-commandments to signal that they aren't commands in that sense. And actually, what we want people to do is to think about their own beliefs in a rational and logical way and ask themselves, am I living the most empathetic, compassionate, and meaningful life I could?
Interesting. All right. So I understand that you have a contest associated with this as well. Can you tell me about that?
Right. So the contest builds directly off that point. My co-author, Lex Bayer, is offering this prize called the Rethink Prize, which is a $10,000 prize. It's 10 $1,000 prizes being offered on our website, atheistmindhumanistheart.com. You can go there and submit beliefs that you have, like say, for example, the world is real, or there is an external reality, or science is the best way to understand the natural world, or empathy and compassion are the roots of human morality. And then you can give your justifications for why you believe these and get your friends to vote for them. And then a panel of celebrity judges will choose the finalists, and 10 people will have helped us crowdsource a new alternative to the Ten Commandments.
So the kind of beliefs that you're looking for are beliefs, are rational beliefs, basically, backed up by good justification and reasoning.
Exactly. Critical thinking is one of the norms that we really push with the belief, with the book. And this is one of those things that applies even to religious people. So if, even if you start with different starting assumptions, like maybe that God exists, that doesn't mean that you can't be thoughtful about your other priorities in life and with the values that you live. So we think that even though our book is written primarily with kind of this broadly secular audience in mind, It has plenty of relevance even to religious people, and it'll help them understand what atheists and humanists do believe. You know, that's been one of the biggest problems, which is that there are so many books written about what atheists and humanists don't believe that people think that we're negative and we're totally combative and that we're all contrarian. And they're not aware that humanists have moral values very similar to other people's. And so the reason that we wrote the book was to help educate people on some of the positive beliefs that we atheists and humanists have.
All right, let me throw a hardball question at you. I feel you might get a little bit of pushback on this one, because generally atheism is only about disbelief in any gods. That's it. Once you start associating atheism with positive beliefs, you start to go outside of atheism and you start adopting other worldviews, such as humanism. So are you actually trying to redefine atheism to be more of a positive claim than just a negative one?
No. I mean, look, we know what atheism means, but the point is that most atheists also believe other things about the world. Our goal is not to overwrite the traditional definition of atheism. That's certainly a useful one. Atheism, just the lack of belief in gods. But that's why we use the phrase atheist mind, humanist heart, to point to the fact that most atheists are also humanist at the end of the day, that they also have some of these other beliefs and values. And these include things like believing that science is the best way to understand the natural world, believing that morality is derived from human experience and not from, from God's will, for example. Sure. And so I think that when we talk about atheists and humanists, we're pointing to this group of people who are they're not just people who disbelieve in God, although we're happy to have pure atheists, but they're people who believe in atheism and something more than that.
Yeah. And that's always been a tricky one. Whenever debating Christians or debating anybody and talking about what an atheist actually means, is it the lack of a belief system or is it a belief system in itself? And you have to admit that along with the disbelief, by necessity, comes certain beliefs. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at. You can't just not believe in God, and then there has to be some beliefs associated with that, including there is no omniscient being overlooking the entire universe. You know, that would be a positive belief that's associated from the lack of belief in any deity.
Right. I mean, with all due respect, the God question is actually a small and really minor question when you think about it in a logical way. I mean, I'm an atheist at the end of the day. I don't believe in God. As a result, I don't factor God into my analysis on a regular basis. Right. Instead, I build my ethics on other factors. That's what we're pointing to. What are those other things that you're leading your life based on if you're not leading them on God principles? Right. And we think that's what most people are doing.
Yeah. And I think that's a very important question and an important conversation to have. We have to not just look at what we don't believe, but we need to look at what we do believe. And it sounds like this is what your book is about.
Right. There's just been such a push in the media over the past few years to demonize atheists as nasty and mean-spirited, or to paint them all as, exact models of Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, when in reality, there's an enormous diversity to the atheist and humanist movement. We are liberal. We're, conservative-ish, we're libertarian, we're all over the spectrum, and it doesn't help to paint with such a broad stroke and paint all atheists as bad people. It's just not true.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. So there are several sections in your book that have very interesting topics in there, and I want to talk about some of those, starting with this idea of belief. Can you kind of kick us off on where you're going in your book with the whole idea of belief?
So one of our ideas in the book is that beliefs have consequences and that the beliefs that you have influence your actions in the world. And one of our thoughts is that you should have good reasons for why you hold your beliefs and that your beliefs ought to be consistent. Now, we argue for this extensively in the book, but I think the most controversial aspect of this is our claim that belief ought to be proportional to the evidence. This is one of these ideas that's talked about in Bayesian reasoning, which is that your belief in a claim ought to be proportional to the amount of evidence. So we take a chapter in the book where we talk about situations where you don't necessarily have all of the evidence or as much evidence as you want, and how you can apply Bayesian reasoning and critical thinking skills to those situations as well.
Hmm. Yeah, that is an interesting conversation, because there are also times when we don't necessarily form beliefs, but we make judgments more based on emotion and our intuition, if you want to call them that, not having all of the information. But the reason why we do that is because we can't possibly expend all this cognitive energy all the time on all these tiny decisions that don't matter. But I guess what you're getting at in the heart of the matter is that when it comes to major life decisions, like a religion, you really can't allow your intuition to make the better judgment. You can't really rely on faith. You need to rely on good, solid reasoning.
Right. Well, we had several millennia of trying to base things off our intuitions, and it didn't go terribly well. And then we started basing things on reason and logic and scientific fact, and we started making some serious progress. This is the story of Basically, how we found out empiricism, or using the scientific method, is the best way to make claims about the natural world and to test them out.
And I know the supernatural, a lot of times, these supernatural claims, some people might say that they interact with the natural world, and therefore they're testable, but every time we've tried to test it, we've never found any positive results. So it's always a tricky argument to have.
My favorite one to talk about with supernatural claims is ghosts. Mm. I always like to ask people this. People who believe in ghosts, I ask them, do the ghosts that you're talking about, what do they look like? Are they wearing clothes or are they naked? And almost always, without fail, they tell me that they're wearing clothes. And then I have to ask them a question, which is, okay, so now you're asking me to not only believe that a person's immortal soul survives after their death and transcends the spirit world, but their clothes also have this supernatural ability to transcend death and move on to the afterlife. I don't understand how that works. Do the ghost clothes haunt the ghost? Is that the mechanism that's operating there? And what clothes is it that the ghost is going to wear? Is it just the clothes that it was wearing when he died, or is it the most common clothes of the day? It basically makes no sense whatsoever. And you can show how silly it is just by pointing out that, you know, why would we believe ghosts exist why would we believe they're clothed? There's not even a shred of logic to this.
Right. No, there isn't. And that's a good point. I think it's all about asking questions and asking the right questions and not just taking because for an answer. For example, there are a lot of these questions that you could ask in the Bible if one wanted to, but I have a feeling that sometimes people just don't want to dig that deep and they're just happy with the surface answers. For example, when Jesus was raised into heaven, they saw his physical body go up into the clouds. All right, how fast was he going? How long does it take to get to heaven? Where is heaven? Is it above the clouds? Is it in outer space? Won't he freeze to death once he gets in outer space? I mean, if you keep asking these questions, the answers result in absurdity, and people just fall back on personal experience.
Yeah, personal experience remains really compelling to people, even though we have many good reasons why personal experience is a bad answer, including things like we now know that eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable in criminal testimony.
Oh, sure.
Any first-year law student learns of this very famous psychological experiment where they ask people to watch a video of people bouncing a basketball back and forth between each other and count the passes. And during the video, a guy in a gorilla suit actually walks through the shot, through the scene, and people who are watching it, keeping track of the bounce passes, don't see the gorilla suit about 70% of the time. So we're notoriously unreliable. We don't construct these things well, and we wonder, why would we take someone's eyewitness testimony from 2,000 years ago when we were even less sophisticated with our skepticism as if it were totally true today? I mean, if you're going to believe Bible stories, why aren't you convinced that, you know, these swamis in modern day India who claim to be able to do miracles, why don't you believe their stories? There's more people who attest to them, and you have better access to those people. And they're fooling people in the modern world who have access to some understanding of science and technology. So it just seems silly.
Yeah, it sure does. I wonder if in your book you touch on the argument from reason. Now, this was popularized in the late 40s by C.S. Lewis, but basically it states the argument that without God, we cannot know anything. We cannot reason. Reason only makes sense from a theistic worldview. What would your response be to that?
That makes no sense. I mean, it's a lovely thing to say, but it just doesn't relate to reality. I mean, from a secular perspective, we have all the same tools that are available. We have induction to the best explanation. We have the tools of Socratic thinking. We have our critical thinking skills. If the question is, why should we trust them? The answer would be because they work, because they yield answers. So in mathematics, we can make predictions about how we think things are going to behave. We can test them out. We can find out if they're true. We can do the same thing in other fields in order to make these predictions. We do it in biology, in physics, in astrophysics on a daily basis. So the argument that there's no grounding for reason on secularism is beyond ridiculous. The grounding for reason is purely secular. And the answer is because it's effective, because it makes repeatable, testable predictions about the world, and because it revises itself when those predictions are shown to be incorrect and encapsulates more data into the evidence.
All right. Well said. Good enough for me. Well, let's talk about the big topic, and this is the fun topic as well, and that's secular morality. As you know, and as you alluded to before, there are many studies that show that atheists are among the most disliked and distrusted group in the United States, and most of this has to do with morality. They believe that without God, you cannot be moral. And I think that, at least from my perspective, we need some serious education to the general public to show how everybody's morality is ultimately secular. So let's talk about secular morality. What do you say in your book about that?
Sure. So I think the most controversial thing we say in the book about morality is that morality is ultimately subjective and not objective. Hmm. And this makes a good contrast with religion, because one reason that so many people are convinced by religiosity is because they think it gives a grounding for objective ethics. But we think that's ridiculous, and we're going to tell you why. So first off, if you believe in objective morality, that means that you believe that there are these things called moral facts that exist in the world. And either if you're a God believer, you think God made them true, or if you happen to be a secular person who believes this, you're like Immanuel Kant or someone like that, then your answer is that these truths just exist in the universe. They're kind of like Platonic forms. They exist apart from time and space. They're just true of the universe. And that's one way of looking at morality, but that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And the reason it doesn't make sense to me is this: that view entails that before any organism evolved that could be murdered, murder was wrong, which just doesn't seem to make sense. And it also entails that if the Earth were to be destroyed by an asteroid and every human being were to be killed on the Earth, that tax fraud would still be wrong, would still be morally wrong. And it just doesn't seem to me plausible that there can be moral facts that relate to organisms that don't exist. If we're the people who experience morality and all of us are gone, how can morality continue? It just makes no sense. Hmm. Our view, on the other hand, is the subjective view of morality, which is that morality is a constructive human project. One famous iteration of this is the social contract idea. from John Locke, Rousseau, and Thomas Hobbes. And this is the idea that early people basically formed morality out of their common need for survival. That as we saw, as we were in a state of nature, there were no protections for people, there was no society, you could be killed at any moment, but you also had total freedom, you could do whatever you wanted. Early people decided to form together into tribes and say, look, I'll protect you and make sure that a cougar doesn't eat you in the night, and then you watch me while I sleep and we'll work out that. And then we'll also agree not to kill each other, and we'll also agree not to steal from each other. And from there, you can see the early groundings of a system of morality based on protecting people's interests and rights. And this is the view that we think makes much more sense, a constructive view of morality that's based on people's preferences and experiences. And as a result, this is better able to explain all sorts of phenomena, like the fact that morality is just different in different places. So compare the American extremely individualistic, kind of very luck-based system to the Canadian or European socialist models, which are much more government protective, and then compare that to Confucian societies in Southeast Asia that have a moral view that places a strong preference on family values, even to the extent that they have laws that require that children take care of their elderly parents into their old age, which we don't have here. We have it the other way around, where you're legally required to take care of your kids. There's no legal obligation to take care of your parents. And so as I look at these three different ways of living life, all of them seem valid to me. It doesn't seem to me like the Confucian way is infinitely better than the American way, which is infinitely better than the European way. It just seems like there are different ways of organizing oneself based on one's preferences and priorities. And all of them seem valid to me, which subjective ethics is able to handle. The reason that their ethics is different in different places is because people are different and their preferences are different.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with John Figdor, who is the author of Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart. So how would you argue or justify somebody's ethics that, say, throws battery acid in the face of women? And in their culture, that's the right thing to do because it's a deterrent for future behavior, which they deem even more immoral than what they're doing with the punishment. So how can, with a subjective morality, how can we look at that? And how could we say that is wrong? Sure. We should not be doing that.
So the fear here is relativism, right? The fear here is that as soon as we say that there isn't one absolute right answers, we have to throw up our hands and say, oh, well, any moral answer is equally right. And that seems like an absurd conclusion to reach. On the other hand, what I would say is that we exist in a world, obviously, where there are different explanations for these phenomena, where there's different reasons people will give for their behavior. And so a person who says, I think it's a good idea to throw battery acid in the face of a girl who has premarital sex, I would say, why do you think that's a good idea? What are your reasons for why you think that's a good principle? And I don't think there's going to be a very rational or logical reason underlying that. I think it's going to have something to do with purity notions or the idea that men ought to control women in some deep way. And there's no justification given for that. It's just based on the arbitrary belief of that person. And if you can't give a good justification for it, that belief isn't going to stick around much longer, because in the modern world, beliefs require justifications. People don't just hop to and do whatever they're told. People want to know why they're doing something. And if you can't give a good justification for it, women aren't going to take it.
So let's work with this subjectivity and go down to the system of values. I think when you were talking, I was kind of hearing that it ultimately comes down to values. So for example, if a culture values like the purity of women or the sanctity of a relationship more than they value a system of being free from some kind of abusive punishment, then who are we to say that their values are messed up?
Well, I think we're in the same place as someone. I mean, look, sociopaths have different values from you and I, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't make us paralyzed with respect to how we can respond to this sociopath who says, I'd like to kill both of you. Our answer is, well, gee, we really would not like to be killed. And now that we know that you want to kill us, we're aware of that, and we're going to treat you differently based on that information. So people who have really aberrant moral perspectives, people who think really hateful and bad things, they actually hurt themselves in the modern world because their reputation gets around and people learn that they're not interested in being cooperative and helpful, but they're obstructionary and not helpful.
Sure.
And so in our view, and this is confirmed by evolutionary research by Professor Axelrod, which is the idea of the evolution of cooperation based on the tit-for-tat game theory research, shows that the best strategies for success are peaceful strategies, not strategies that try to be clever and cheat people out of their resources or try to intimidate them to gain access. Actually treating people with a broadly fair strategy it gives you the best results at the end of the day. And so we think that just based on your own self-interest should drive you towards this kind of behavior. On top of all of your moral reasoning and all of your empathetic reasons, just self-interest at a certain point should drive you to recognize that that's the best way to live.
Yeah, that research in that whole field of tit-for-tat and the different game theories is really fascinating. If anybody wants to look into that, I would say do it, because there is this one idea that exactly like you said, the ideal strategy is the tit-for-tat, which means that I will do a good thing for you, you do a good thing for me, and we'll keep this going until you screw me over. Once you screw me over, I'll screw you over, and then you have to stop screwing me over before I start doing a good thing again.
Exactly.
And that's the strategy that works, but there are something called defectors, and defectors can game the system, and they could get an advantage only for a while, though. Because if there are too many defectors, then they kind of lose and the other side wins. So there is kind of like the self-balancing system that continues and weeds these defectors out. But the scary thing is that defecting does work. So if you think about like a perfect system.
But not in the long run.
No. That's right. Not in the long run.
You see this even in the business world where there's an inclination towards trying to be more open about your transactions because there's more information out there in the world.
Sure.
It's way easier to catch people in lies now because we make reporting so important. We make open exchange of information so important.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so that's the key. Like in the long run, this is certainly the best strategy, but not everybody thinks long term and long run. And that's where we run into some of these issues. And then, of course, as you suggested before, there are people who are mentally disturbed, who are psychopaths, sociopaths that just don't play the game. They just don't play by the same rules. But we got to deal with those people as well.
Right.
All right, moving on. Do you ever have to argue against this idea of objective morality? And if you do, what are your arguments for that? For example, in speaking with a theist, they may argue that God is objective morality. And that's what they believe. And you could say, well, wait, how do you know that? How do you know what exactly is objective? Do you have like a standard argument, a line of argumentation to try to weed out somebody's belief that there really is an objective morality?
Sure. Well, here's one classic example, which is Jean-Paul Sartre in his essay, Existentialism is a Humanism, gives us the question of a young man who is choosing between two decisions, either to stay at home and help his ailing mother with her illness, and she's quite ill and will die if he leaves, or he can go off and join the resistance and fight the Nazis and defend his country. Now, an objective view of morality would have it that one of these answers is right and one of them is wrong. Either from a utilitarian perspective, you can add up all the sum happiness that derives from each of these options and you just pick the bigger number. Or from a Kantian way, one of them is actually more purely right and ought to be embraced for that reason. But that doesn't seem to make any sense to me. This is a situation in which we're not choosing between the right choice and the wrong choice. We're choosing between two very good options. And what I would say is this. If the young man was raised in a household that strongly valued the idea of learning, education, and caring for people who are not well, then he's probably going to be inclined to care for his mother. That's going to be the cultural context that he was raised in. If, on the other hand, he's raised in a family which strongly places a value on standing up for oneself and maybe defending people who can't defend themselves and standing up for freedom, well, then he's probably going to be inclined to go and join the resistance. And it doesn't seem to me to be helpful to pretend like one option is good and one option is bad. It just seems to me like their values depend on what that person's preferences are. And I see this in a daily basis in my students coming to me to ask questions about what they should do with their lives. I mean, in some objective sense, and sorry, there is no objective sense, but in some way, like maybe all of these Stanford students could become trauma surgeons in the third world, right? And maybe that might be the most technically useful way for them to spend their time. But I don't think the average person wants to get forced into being a trauma doctor. I think that they want to do what is the best application of their own skills and talents. And if one of those students tells me, gee, John, I really want to work on medical device research, or I want to research, how we form memories in the brain, it doesn't seem like being a professor is a worse choice at the end of the day than becoming a trauma surgeon. They're both urgent needs, and they both reflect the person's values in that choice.
Right. Yeah, those are some good points. And I also get annoyed when somebody does try to make the argument for an objective morality. The examples they always use are always ridiculously clear examples, like extreme cases of like beating up babies or torturing little children or something like that. They never look at moral dilemmas, which are basically what our society is made up of, what we face every day. We face choices of two very good choices, or sometimes two very bad choices. And either way, there's going to be consequences, but it's just a matter of which one. And these are things that we need to deliberate, and we need to think about the consequences. We don't need to turn to some pretend source of objectivity. And my complaint about this, too, is when somebody does argue for a religious objective morality, then I say, well, what do you know is actually right and wrong? I mean, how do you know these things? It's certainly not from the Bible, because the Bible is not clear about any of this. I mean, of course, they could point to the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. Okay, well, let's look at that. So, right. I can't go to war and fight for my country. Well, no, because that's different. And so I can't protect myself if somebody's trying to kill me. No, that's different too. And okay, where are you getting those rules from? That's not in the Bible anywhere. And it's a way just for them to read their own morality back into the Bible.
Well, it's also just that the objective view of morality is incoherent at a certain sense, which is it really can't make sense of the time frame. I mean, it doesn't make sense to believe that morality existed before there were people and would continue to exist after there were people. It seems way more plausible to say, gee, I think morality basically emerged when people started making moral contracts, when people started choosing to bond together to improve their survival. And in that way, what we find out is that morality is essentially a survival mechanism in a sense, or at least it fits into our evolutionary framework.
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. But I would also even make it even simpler than that and say, look, I don't care if you believe in an objective morality. The fact is, you cannot demonstrate that you have access to this objective morality if it even does exist.
Well, this is the point that we make in the book, which is that, Immanuel Kant thinks that he has an objective system of morality, and Sam Harris thinks that he has an objective system of morality, and Peter Singer thinks that he has an objective system of morality. And I can keep listing people who think that they have objective views of morality. Each one of them has very good arguments for why they think they're right, but no one of these arguments is so much better than the others that it seems plausible to conclude that, oh, actually, it's just John Rawls who is right and the other ones are completely wrong.
Yeah, well, not only that, you would have to take all these people that claim to have an objective system of morality, and you should be able to take these moral dilemmas, present them to them, and all of them should come up with the exact same answer if they do have this truthful, objective system of morality. But what we find is that's just not the case.
That's also true. the application of these, there's always subjectivity, right?
Because
people are implementing these. So whether it's in the interpretation of the objective rules, which still don't make sense on a structural level, or even claiming that there are objective rules, it just doesn't balance.
No, it doesn't. And I like to use the analogy, it's like taking the product of a negative number and a positive number, you're always going to get a negative number. Likewise, if you take the product of an objective and a subjective, you're always going to get a subjective.
Right.
Do you bring people to this conclusion that there is no objective morality and it's all subjective? Or do you kind of lead them in that direction and leave it up to them? Is that one of the things that they decide in making their own commandments?
So in the book, we argue that morality isn't objective. Instead, we argue for a subjective view of morality. But we're not imposing our view on other people. If you come to a different conclusion, that's fine. But we do think that you should have some kind of answer for the arguments that we were talking about. Like, how would you demonstrate that your objective system is truly objective? How would you convince other people that your system was truly objective? All those kinds of objections, and how you could deal with the temporality issues. And if you could deal with those, then I'd be very interested in hearing about it.
Yeah.
And that's a real interesting project of this book, which is, unlike the original Ten Commandments, what our final commandment is that all of these beliefs are open to revision based on new evidence. And this is the most important thing. They literally carve the original Ten Commandments in stone.
Allegedly.
And that's a mistake, because our morals should evolve as we get more information. Think of it this way. At one point in time, we had no understanding of how disease spread itself. And I'm sure we did some really awful things back in the day. I mean, we know some of them. We know the Salem witch trials are one outcome of this, where we executed people for putting hexes on people. I mean, it's ridiculous that people died for this. Morality ought to evolve over time as our evidence increases and as we learn more things about the world. When we learn that disease isn't spread by elderly old ladies whispering satanic runes to people, and we learn that disease propagates itself through germs or through viruses and bacteria, well, guess what? Our morality ought to change with that. And we've seen this happen in a number of things. I mean, if we stuck with the original morality, we'd still think that slavery was okay. We would still think that women shouldn't have a right to vote. And it just seems to me like morality, like everything else, ought to be open to change with the times as we gain more information and learn more and are able to integrate more into our analysis.
Absolutely. I just watched that movie, 12 Years a Slave. Have you seen that?
I have not.
Oh, wonderful movie. Very powerful movie. And just kind of like in shock the whole time, just watching it, thinking about how things like this could have actually happened in our fairly recent history, if you look at things in that perspective. But how the slave owner is reading straight from the Bible, all these verses that we're all familiar with, to the bunch of slaves just trying to keep them in line, telling them how God is supports the idea that they could get beaten for doing all these things. And just crazy ridiculous.
Right. Well, there's another answer to the objective morality thing, right? Christians claim to have an objective morality, but they came down on both sides of the slavery debate. Yeah. Initially, they came down in much greater numbers in support of slavery, and eventually through the work of people like William Lloyd Garrison, they eventually changed their minds on this. But if objective morality existed, it certainly wasn't helpful at the time.
Yeah. And it's the same argument. You know, even if there were an objective morality, they'll just say, well, you know, Satan's getting in the way and making people misunderstand the Bible. Well, yeah, you could use any excuse you want, but the at the end of the day, your objective morality is subjective, functionally. Well, John, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for being on with us. Where can people go to find more about you and your book?
Sure. They can find out about my work and my organization at humanistconnection.org, and they can find out more about our book at atheistmindhumanistheart.com, and they can find our book at amazon.com and in fine bookstores near you.
All right, John, thanks again for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
That was
Mr. John Figdor, author of Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart. And I have the pleasure of speaking with Annabelle Bennett, my daughter in the studio. How are you, Annabelle?
I'm good. Thanks for asking.
I heard that your friend Todd made the paper the other day. What for?
Well, Todd is a special needs kid who everyone in the school loves, and then he would just was moving back to Thailand. So he's been at high school for 4 or 5 years, and then he was going to be here for another 3. But since he was leaving, everyone had a clap out for him, so the whole school went outside, and he drove in the golf cart, and we all clapped for him. Say goodbye.
And that's great. And it did make the local Sudbury paper, and it was a pretty touching story. There were some tears, I understand.
Oh, yeah, a bunch of teachers cried.
Yeah, that's great. And what really gets me about that story is back when I was a kid, there was a lot of bullying and making fun of people who were different. And I just don't see that in schools today, and I think that's a great thing. And I know people will point to, back in the old days, people were so much nicer, but that's just not true. And you're proof of that.
Oh, yeah.
So thanks for being the younger generation.
Yeah, we're good. Society's a good place now.
Thanks, Annabelle.
No problem.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for having me on your wonderful show.
Thank you. And if you would like to leave any listener feedback, send me an email at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Until next week, bye-bye, everybody.